into the mathematical background it takes. So once we get through these first two points, then taking a quotient group, we've got a central theorem to the subject that I'll prove here. I'll prove that that quotient is a manifold.
Take a day. You know, it's not a hard proof, really. It's fairly easy to see that it works, and we'll write things down that'll make it clear. So, just to recap, take S for an overview.
Okay.
So, we've developed differential forms. We're halfway through Lie groups and Lie algebras. We've done a lot of examples. Today I want to talk about some formal developments to show the general statement of what we have been seeing examples of. And then I'll do spin groups. I want to hold off on spin groups because they rely on this notion of Lie algebras for you to really understand what they are. Then we can move to fiber bundles and construction of gauge theory.
So, and then, you know, the rest is basically looking at various gauge theories and seeing what we've got. Any other questions while we're answering questions? I think Nathan had some. You all have problems due. You have problems to turn in?
Yeah, I think we're done.
You know, the differential forms problems are due as of, 2 weeks ago? Whenever it was? Was it three? I don't know.
I think it's Friday.
They're
due.
Turn them in. now, if not sooner. Why don't we, while we're on the subject of problems, step back and I know Nathan had a question on some of those last ones from Jackson, the translation into differential forms. Did you get those ones?
I started them.
Okay. Let's do one or two of those just together and see where we are. So, what you got, Nathan?
Well, how far do you want to go?
Doesn't matter. You're looking at like a triple cross product or something. That's fine.
Yeah, I can do that one.
Would that one help? What would help most?
Basically, I can transform both the left hand side and the right hand side into differential forms. But to get the differential forms of if you convert the left hand side to differential forms. And then use that to derive and prove the right hand side. That's where it comes.
You get something different.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, give me a challenging example that where you run into that problem.
Well, try to prove that the right hand side is correct for the triple cross product.
So triple cross. So we've got three vectors: A cross quantity, B cross C.
Right.
Like that.
And you like to write that, I suppose, in terms of dot products and things. Is that the general idea?
Yes.
We should be able to.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Looking at this tells us that we're going to be able to do that, because a cross product always involves an epsilon.
Mm-hmm.
And two cross products are two epsilons, and we know we can reduce that to crossers or metrics.
Mm-hmm.
So that we should be able to get rid of all the epsilons in this expression, and the only way we can do that is if we're writing it in terms of some dot product times vector.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, some kind of identity should come out of this. So, I'm going to define forms, AI, DXI. Let's see, I guess we're in three dimensions here.
Yeah.
VI, DXI. So, we'll look at the covariant form of these three vectors. Make differential forms out of them. Now, to write B cross C, we know we can write as B wedge C, and then we take the dual of that, and that gives us another vector. And then what we want to do is take another cross product, so A cross quantity B cross C,
should be the dual of A wedge
D cross C. So this thing here,
dual of B wedge B.
So that's the object we're working with. So we're going to replace this by star quantity A wedge star quantity B wedge C. So I start working from the inside out and see what we've got. B wedge C is equal to star of A wedge star. And now we have a two form. D wedge C is BI CJ DXI wedge DXJ. Close paren. And now I come out to the next star. So we have star of A wedge. And now I take the code. I leave a space because I'm going to have a factorial something. And then I'm going to write the coefficient BI CJ.
What's that?
It's going to be 1, yeah. Yeah, it's going to go to a 1 form. So it's 1 over 1 factorial. And I usually wait till I write the DXs for it. But you know, here, yeah, you can see it right away, and why not? Then I need to raise a couple of indices on my Levy-Civita tensor, IJ. I'll leave the K down. So there are two metrics I've used to raise those indices. And then we have DXK. There's one of those, and so I put my one factorial down there, and we're good. Then we have A wedge that, so let's write AK, no, not, can't use K, let's see, what do we have to do? L, A sub L, BI, CJ, EIJK DX L wedge DXK. So I just wedged A into it. And now I'm taking the dual of a two form. Let's come up here. So we have star A wedge B wedge C equals. Okay, so now all of this is the coefficient. So I write the coefficient. A, and one's going to tell me it's a one form in the end, so I'm going to put my one factorial here. So A, L, what do we got? B, I, C, J.
B, I, C, J. E, I, J, F.
K down?
No.
Okay, now, what's free?
L, K, or free.
L and K, good. So I put E, L, K in that order. M, because I've got the X, L, the X, K, so I put those first two in that same order. And then we have a DXM. Okay, now, let me put these indices in a little bit different position. What do I want to do? Let me drop the IJ and raise the IJ on B and C, just to make it a little tidier. I'm going to put those two up, and I'm going to put those two down. So I have IJK here. And now, I can put the M up if I put a metric GMN. I can write this as E, L. Now, I like to keep the summed index last, so I'm also going to interchange. I've got LKN, but I'm going to write NK with a minus sign, and then I have DXM. So I did two things at once there. This is just making it tidy so that my identity is easier to see. Now, in these two epsilons, there's this one has a root determinant of the metric. That has one over the root determinant of the metric. Those cancel.
So we just have the epsilon identity. Let's keep track here. L, B, I, C, J. Then, so a pair of anti-symmetric symbols will give Kronecker L, I, Kronecker, N, J, minus Kronecker N, I, Kronecker, L, J. And I think the trace is already, the trace needs to give 6. Here I get 3 times 3 is 9, minus the trace of a single Kronecker is 3, gives 6. So there's no factor there that's needed. And then, what did I do funny? Oh, there's a DMN and a DXM. Okay, everybody with me?
So can we just throw out that piece since we're working with Euclidean flat space?
Flat space can have a non-Euclidean metric.
Yeah, sure, you could.
I mean, you know, if you want to do this in Euclidean, that's fine. But you change coordinates and that G is suddenly something else.
So
I'd say keep it. You know, it's not going to hurt anything to have it there. Now let's use these Kronekers. The first term, that's the Li. So we Li, that's just A dot B. And then we have C. What happens? Cn, this lowers the index, and it's contracted on dx, so it's just the one form C. I can write it like that if I want. A vector dot B vector, we know what that number is. Then, plus, are we coming out with the right thing?
Yeah.
Is this looking good? Then this one, Kronecker NILJ, gives us A dot C. So we're going to have the dot product of A with C. And then this becomes just B. And we've got the back cab rule.
Oh, yeah, that's sufficient.
Okay. So you see how it goes through there. I think they should all be, you know, similarly.
Yeah,
just,
pretty much.
You push through and you use these identities on epsilons. It's almost the only transformation you're going to need before you turn things into dot products and stuff. Anyone else? Questions? Is that enough? Do you want to see any other of these examples, Chuck?
They're all pretty much the same.
Yeah, I think,
yeah,
you know,
they're
all this kind of thing. But this is what I had in mind, anyway. You know, interpret this in any way that you like, basically, that is sufficient to convince you that what you've got is some version of what's in the book there. And so, you know, the usual back cab rule, B times A dot C minus C times A dot B, that's, you know, the way I learned ages ago to remember it. You know, the I remember learning it like, okay, back B times A dot C minus cash C A B dot B. Now that's
how I learned it too.
Yeah, that's what I remember. But clearly that's what we've got here. That's just a scalar. You write it anywhere you want. So we've proved the back end. Shall we move on to formal development? You guys ready? Or you're good with Diffie forms? Question? Okay. So we're in free space here,
right.
And with ordinary vectors, let's see, the, I guess I'm inclined to do it with the vector notation. So we've got know, we've got a couple of vectors, A and B, and you know what we want is it's A dot B we're after.
Right.
Okay, A dot B.
So
so our starting point is that GIJ AI BJ. Suppose that's our definition of it. You know, well, you know, so what is this?
In the projection of A onto B. That's the interpretation of that.
Yeah, it is. I'm wondering if, maybe the best way to go here is, a triangle relation, so that we write, A dot B, we could write A plus B, what's the magnitude squared of that vector? All right. If you remember that A dot B, all right, even by this definition, it's clear this is what we mean by the norm of the vector A squared. All right, that's the length squared of A. That's what we mean by it. Then if we look at this thing, this is A plus B dot A plus B. I'm hoping this gets us where we want. I'm not positive. We'll see. But this does come out in terms of norm, so it might work. So we get an A squared, and we get a B squared, and then we're going to get twice. Since A dot B is symmetric in A and B, we get twice A dot B. But now, that gives us A dot B in terms of three norms. I have a feeling that the Pythagorean theorem is going to help here. Right? If we look in the plane of A and B, so we've got a vector A, we've got a vector B, then this says that A dot B is going to be half of A plus B length squared minus B squared and A squared. And so let's draw our A plus B by the parallelogram rule. That vector is A plus B. And now let's see. How can we make it right triangle out of all this? What you'd like to do is, you can use something like that. This has got to be B going that way, because that's the construction. If I drop a perpendicular here, then what does that say? That's not quite it. We know that we can write the length of this side as what is it?
Stay in there.
This is funny. I did this last spring. I think I did it in intro. I derived this formula. It was easier than this. What am I missing?
can't see. The length of that thing.
I always just used the answer and prove that they were equal.
And
what's that? Subtract them?
No, when you're taking the, when you're expanding the polynomial, new bracket.
Here?
Yeah, no, taking the minus there, A minus B, A plus B.
We could consider the norm of A minus B, mm-hmm. and that might, you know, then the difference of those is going to depend on that. And that might be useful, but let's see, I'm trying to get the trick angling here. You know, the angle that we're interested in, if we continue A off that way, the angle is this one here, the angle between A and B. And we can, it's probably not that normal I want, but if I drop a normal down to there, so I have a right angle, then what I'm not seeing is where the half comes from. That's what's annoying. This side, that's this side down here. That side there is B, the norm of B, length of B times the cosine of theta. That's just taking a component. We know we can do that. So, this side over here is has length D times the sine of theta. So from the Pythagorean theorem, we can write B squared sine squared theta plus A norm plus B cos theta quantity squared has to be equal to norm of A plus B squared. And if we square this out, we're going to get a cosine squared term, so we'll get a norm of B here. Then we're going to get an A squared, and then we get a cross term, twice norm of A, norm of B, times the cosine of theta. So if we compare our two formulas, we just got it. So, not bad for a question out of the blue. that's one way to do it. There must be hundreds. Play around with the geometry, draw pictures, use basic theorems, and, it comes out, usually. I got an email from your math friend.
Oh, good.
Brian, is it?
Yeah.
That's trying to set up a time.
Oh, good,
It sounds like fun. Thanks for being the go-between there.
Oh, no problem.
Be fun to talk with you. Okay, so, any other, just thing you've been curious about for months or years? Want to see?
Can you tell me in just a second what you've done here?
Two different problems.
Okay.
There are three things on the board. One is an overview of what we've done and where we're going.
Yeah, I see that. Mm-hmm.
Then we did an example of the differential forms translating one of those formulas I gave and working through to see that we get the usual back cab rule. That is part of this. And then starting up here, Juan wanted to know. Wanted to see a proof that A dot B is magnitude A, magnitude B, cosine theta. So we were just proving the two forms of the dot product are equal. So that's one way to do it. Seems to me I've seen a simpler way to do it, but that's not so bad, really. Okay. Proceed with lecture. Okay, let's go.
Now that we have two boards full.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to... I want to establish the existence of a Lie algebra associated with a Lie group. Right. So that's the claim. Let me just say Lie group. A Lie group gives rise to a Lie algebra.
Marker. Try again. No.
One of these will work. All right, recall a Lie group. What do we have? We have three properties. It's a group. It's a manifold, and the group product is continuous. And that's enough to, what that says is that we can label group elements by some set of n-real numbers. That's our n-dimensional chart to an n-dimensional manifold, and multiplying two group elements whose parameters are close to one another gives nearby group elements as the product. The algebra we haven't actually been quite formal enough with our definition of this, but I think the examples will make it clear that this definition is not unreasonable. A Lie algebra is a vector space with a closed anti-symmetric bracket product satisfying the Jacobi identity. Okay, so stated that definition before, so let me show you how it fits with the examples we've done, and then what I want to prove is that a Lie group always gives us just exactly one of those.
You good here, Jeff?
Okay, so example of the Lie algebra. The vector space equals the set of all linear combinations of the generators. Take as my vector space. What do we have? We've got, for example, we had Ji, J, like J, Jx, Jy, and Jz.
to give us either SO3 or SU2. In the SO3 case, they were some 3x3 matrices. In the SU2 case, they were the poly matrices, or some suitable multiple of the poly matrices. But either way, we get three of them, and they satisfy Jx with Jy is, what do we get? We get 2i Jz, you know, and cyclic. If we want to write that with the Levy-Civita tensor, we can write Ji with Jj equals 2i epsilon ijk, j sub k. And this is true whether we're talking about SU3 or SU2. There's something very much the same about these two groups. And yet there's something different by being precise about Lie algebra and their relationship to the groups, we'll be able to see more clearly what that relationship between these two groups is. Okay, so this is what I mean by this anti-symmetric product. A closed anti-symmetric product, it closes because it comes back into, well, actually, some constant times the generators. If I let Z be any linear combination of the generators, that's a general vector. That's my general element of, let's call this vector space D. So my vector space is made up of such linear combinations. Let's let U be another combination. Then this product extends to all of these, because the this product is linear. You know, we're dealing with a vector space. Everything here is going to be linear. So if I've got a multiple of generators, I can pull out the coefficients. This J is some matrix, but those U's are just some real numbers. Then if I take the commutator with Vj with J sub J, I can pull out these coefficients, Ui, Vj, and I've got Ji with Jj, and I know what that is. That is Ui with Vj, and then I've got some commutator. Let's see, we chose these so there was no I here. I'm sorry. Let's do it that way. I was thinking of the poly matrices, but I don't want the I's there. Then we get an epsilon ijk summed with a jk times 2. And that is a linear combination of the generators again. We've got the structure constants. In this case, the 2 epsilon ijk are structure constants. With the emphasis on constants. So what we've got is U with Z is some number twice Ui Vj epsilon ijk summed with the I should probably put that last index up to keep my position right. J sub k. That's an element of Z.
Alright, it's twice the cross product of U with Z if it happens to be three dimensions of this particular group. So the thing is, what I want you to see is that if we have these generators, and the generators satisfy some commutation relations, then any linear combination of them also satisfies some commutator algebra. So in fact, we, since the set of all linear combinations of any set of basis objects gives us a vector space,
we now have this linear bracket that we can apply to any element
of that vector space. So the bracket extends.
The Jacobi identity extends as well. The Jacobi identity says that if we take any three of these and cyclically permute the labels and add those permutations, we're going to get zero. Well, we're obliged to now show that this holds for any U, V, and W. Let W be W, I, J, I. Then, if I just multiply by, let's say, W, I, U, J, and V, K, what we get is the commutator, you know, bring those coefficients inside this relation, and this is W with U with V, plus the U goes here, then on the K we have V, and then the I we have W, and we're just permuting these three vectors. Then the K gets a V, I gets a W, and J gets a U. And that is zero. So you see, we can take any three elements of the vector space. An element of the vector space is of any linear combination of the generators. So we can take any three elements of the vector space, and the Jacobi identity applies to them. We usually go the other way when we do stuff with vector spaces. We have these vectors, they've got some abstract properties, and we show that, you know, any dot product or something can be expressed in terms of the dot product of the basis vectors, and you call that thing the metric. Here, in the examples we've seen so far, we've seen that we have these commutation relations and the cyclic identity, but in fact, that comes from these more general properties of commutation and Jacobi of vectors. We could have done this with any of the groups that we've looked at so far. In every case, in the case of the Lorentz group, SL2C, we had six generators, the J's and the K's. We could take some six-dimensional vectors, an arbitrary linear combination of all six of those, and we can add such linear combinations to get other linear combinations. Just check through the axioms of a vector space. Just distributive laws, additivity. It's a group under addition, and you've got scalar multiplication. Well, you certainly have that if you have any kinds of basis vectors. You remember my example, you know, you've got a smiley frowning face and a smiley face. You want a vector space, you take all linear combinations, alpha times the happy face and beta times the frowning face, and, you know, that is the general element of your vector space, and what you've created is a set of ordered pairs, alpha, beta, and they're going to do what vectors do. Just define scalar multiplication here to satisfy distributive laws and combine things like with real numbers, and it'll be a vector space. It'll do just what you expect a vector space to do, no differently than if you had called this I hat and that J hat and this the XY twine. It still does the same stuff. Okay. Questions on sort of why this space of generators is a Lie algebra, is a vector space? Is that much clearer? Yeah, question.
Let me hold on real quick. No.
Okay.
I'm just looking back and okay. By definition, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So far, nothing magical has happened. What
where the magic comes is when we show that any Lie group gives rise to just such a vector space. And we've done it a few times now, so we've really seen that this does happen. So we'll just do it in general this time. We'll pick a Lie group, use the properties of the Lie group, and show that the infinitesimal generators always give us this kind of structure. Let's just set about doing that.
So we're good?
All right, yeah. I think you're better.
Good. Have you got this?
Yes.
I'll get that out of your way.
There you go. So, all right, so
we're good. Okay. We know what the groups are. So, because we've got continuity, because the groups are manifold, a real manifold, because they are parameterized by real variables, we can do a Taylor series of the group element. And let's start with a Lie group. Capital G. And we have elements, consider elements G1, G2, G3 in that Lie group. Such that G1 is near the identity. So we think of this now as a Taylor series. So what we have is, let me say a little bit about these elements. For all G in big G, we can write G at some x1, x2, xn. For G near the identity, do we know what that means? Right. We know what that means because the parameters that specify a group near the identity have to be near to the parameters that specify the identity. Continuity gives us that. So let the identity be G at zero parameter values. Then we conclude that G near the identity is equal to something with parameter values. G is G of epsilon is equal to 1 plus epsilon. So we can expand it out in terms of some new operators G. These are going to be our infinitesimal generators. So we call these the infinitesimal generators. And now, let G1, G2, G3 be near the identity. So we and let them satisfy the product. Hang on. Just trying to think how I want to say it. Let G1 and G2 be near the identity. And consider no, still not there.
it follows that G1 inverse and G2 inverse are near the identity. Okay, we need a little proof. Proof's not hard. If G1 is 1 plus epsilon dot our generators, then G1 inverse is 1 minus epsilon dot the generators. Since G1 inverse is then 1 plus epsilon dot G, 1 minus epsilon dot G is equal to 1 plus epsilon dot G minus epsilon dot G plus order epsilon squared. And that is negligible. So we take it small enough that we can ignore that. These two cancel, and that's 1. So to this order, we have the inverses. And then we simply note, oh, look, that's in the neighborhood of the identity. So this assignment holds. If you want the proof for 2, change all the 1s to 2. Okay. Now, parenthetical. Think of these generators, the set of n generators, as a direction.
Every one in each dimension, right?
Yeah, there's one for every. You can think of it as a directional derivative. So, you know, we're on some manifold here. You know, the manifold is the group. You know, somewhere over here is the identity. And, you know, when we go off in the epsilon G direction, you know, that's some directional derivative away from, you know, there's an epsilon 1, here's an epsilon 2 dot G, is a different linear combination of those, you know, say, coordinate derivatives. So, you know, what you're doing is moving a little bit away in some direction, and which direction you move just depends on those parameters. So, varying the parameters differently is moving you away from the identity in some different direction along that manifold. So, you know, you could talk about curves as you smoothly vary some parameter. You know, you could choose some your favorite set of coordinates here and vary just x1 and see where that takes you. No, that'll take you off there. X2 will take you somewhere different. So what I want to consider is G1 and then G2 taking it somewhere else, and then G1 inverse taking it somewhere else, and finally G2 inverse, bringing it probably back close to 1.
That's how we get a commutator.
This is how we're going to get a commutator, exactly. Considering the product of all 4 of these, you know, actually takes us around something that's a little loop, but it doesn't have to come back to the identity. In fact, if we look at G1, G2, G1 inverse, G2 inverse, it's clear that that's a group element. If the group is abelian, we get back to the identity. But if it's not abelian, we don't expect to. Equals 1 if G is abelian. But equals G3 in general. All right. G3 is close to the identity. we can't do a bunch of infinitesimal things like this and get very far away. So it's going to be close to the identity. This is 1 plus some linear combination. Let's call it, what should I call it? Let me use gamma. some gamma dot are generators. Okay. I claim it's near the identity. There's no way by combining, four things that look like that we're going to get very far away.
That'd be really curved now.
Very badly curved. But we can always take the epsilon smaller. So, have I defined these things yet? So, let G1 be identity plus epsilon dot the generators. G2, let's choose a different letter, say eta dot the generators. And choose. Keep making G's. Choose epsilon and eta small enough. So that gamma is small. There. Now we've got it. What I want to do is just see what this looks at like at the lowest order where we actually get something. Let's see. What order do we need? Is linear order going to be enough? At linear order, what does this look? What we have is, how do I do this? G2 inverse, G1 inverse, G2, G1 is what? This is G3. But this is going to be 1 minus eta dot g, 1 minus epsilon dot g, 1 plus eta dot g, 1 plus epsilon dot g. And it's associative, so I can just multiply these all together. What do we get? Here's 1 minus eta dot g, multiply these two, so I'm going to get minus epsilon dot g. Then for the last two factors, I'm going to have 1 plus eta dot g plus epsilon dot g plus order epsilon squared, eta squared, or epsilon eta, second order stuff. And I multiply those out to first order, and I get 1. So, first order is not enough. We need to go to second order. Well, if we have to keep second order terms, we'd better put them in from the start. So, let's put in second order terms. Be something off in the epsilon direction that will go to second order. We know this thing turns into an exponential, right? So what we really need are the first two terms of an exponential. Epsilon dot g plus 1/2 epsilon dot g squared, and so on. The 2 factorial is 2. Just to simplify the notation, let epsilon be epsilon dot g. So I don't have to write out that dot product every time I do a term. Just the symbol epsilon will be enough. So 1 plus epsilon plus 1/2 epsilon squared. Some higher order terms, we won't need
What's T1 inverse now?
1 minus
and plus.
Oh, it's
plus. It'll be plus.
Yeah.
Okay. So, check. 1 plus epsilon plus a half epsilon squared times 1 minus epsilon, does it work? Plus half epsilon squared is 1 minus epsilon plus a half epsilon squared. And this, then we have epsilon minus epsilon squared plus a cubic term I drop. Then here I add a half epsilon squared and everything's cubic or quartic. So order epsilon cubed I drop. And these two cancel as before, but then notice that the two half pieces just cancel the third and we get the identity. So
we've got the inverse here.
In the inverse T1
yes.
series,
yes.
Before you have the ellipses at the end,
mm-hmm.
is that going to be a negative? So go to alternate.
Oh, the next sign will, yeah, it'll probably be
negative.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the exponential of e to the minus epsilon g. By the time we get to that point,
so
all you have to do is change the sign of epsilon. So odd terms are minus. Okay, so let's go back and consider our thing. Now, these parameters, by the way, I want to stress epsilon and eta and gamma. These are constant fixed infinitesimal vectors. So, T2 inverse, T1 inverse, T2, T1. We now write, all right, here we go. Take a deep breath. 1 minus eta plus half eta squared. Times 1 minus epsilon plus a half epsilon squared. Times, I heard that deep breath. 1 plus eta plus a half. Good job. And finally, 1 plus epsilon plus a half epsilon squared. And we just multiply it all out and see what happens. This is G3. We're doing very well at guaranteeing gamma coming out near the identity, right? Because it's, you know, to linear order, gamma is zero. To linear order in epsilon and eta, gamma is zero. So we really are getting
much more than
it's small. Okay, so. I'll multiply these two and then those two and then see what we have after that. 1 minus epsilon plus a half epsilon squared plus eta minus eta epsilon, that's cubic order, plus a half eta squared cubic quartic. So I'm just dropping the big stuff, the really, really little stuff. the one over the big stuff.
Where's that 1 half eta squared coming from? Yeah.
That's this term times the 1.
Okay. Okay.
So here's 1 times all of that. Boom, boom, boom. Eta times the first 2. Eta squared times the first 2. Then times, here we do the same thing. We have 1 plus epsilon plus a half epsilon squared plus eta epsilon. Plus a half eta squared. Okay, this looks at this point much harder than it is. The 1 gives us all of that again. 1 plus epsilon plus a half epsilon squared plus eta epsilon plus a half eta squared. We know that anything, you know, in terms of just epsilons is going to cancel. Anything in terms of just eta is only going to be eta epsilon stuff that can survive, because we've got a, for every g, we've got a g inverse. So, you know, if we get a term where is it? Yeah, if we get a term that only depends on epsilon, it's as if that G2 and G2 inverse were just one, and we're just multiplying G1 inverse times G. So those terms are going to come down to a one. So a lot of this is going to go away. Nevertheless, let's press on. Here we have minus epsilon. Minus epsilon squared. Third order, minus epsilon eta. Third order. Done here. Okay, epsilon squared. We have plus 1/2 epsilon squared.
That's it.
Eta. We've got eta epsilon. Third order, eta squared. Third order. Done. Here, we have minus, as an erasure is better. Minus eta epsilon, and done.
Just one term,
plus 1/2 eta squared. Thank you. And there's betting a whole lot of things cancel. We already saw, all of the linear stuff is going to go away. If I got my signs right.
Did you positive?
What happened? That should be negative. Right? Let's see. These two signs are backwards. I have 1 times this stuff here. I have minus eta times this stuff. That's minus eta plus 1 eta. Then this term's right. So down here, the 1 stuff took me to here. That's all right. Then here, minus epsilon, that one's okay. How far did that take me? Epsilon squared, epsilon eta. So to here we're good. That's this epsilon. The epsilon squared, it was fine. Then this eta makes these two terms negative.
Oh, there we go.
And then this term, eta epsilon, is that this one? Oh, this.
So I got one.
Oh, minus eta squared. This one's negative too. Okay. These three terms are this eta. Then this term hits the 1 and gives us a positive. And then this term's a negative. Okay. I think we fixed it. See, eta again. The epsilon squared. Let's look here. We have epsilon squared minus epsilon squared plus 1/2 epsilon squared. So those three go away. The eta squared, as promised. There's a plus 1/2 and a minus 1 and a plus 1/2. So that and that. And that. And what are we left with?
Zero.
Well, not necessarily. They don't commute.
We've got them.
Oh, if they don't commute.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's look carefully. We have 1 plus eta epsilon minus epsilon eta minus eta epsilon plus eta epsilon. Well, those certainly cancel. No problem there. But that's the commutator. And now maybe the time to expand this back out. Right? This is 1 plus eta A epsilon B commutator of GA with GB. Right, that's my eta dot g, my epsilon dot g, written out where capital A, capital B run 1 to n. So just introducing some images. On the other hand, since we can write g3 as the identity plus some
gamma, let's call it C, G, C. That has to be equal to A, epsilon, B, G, A, G, C. That gamma C is some linear function, and we almost said this, because of the G1 inverse and G2 inverse, anything involving only epsilon can only be the identity. It's, you know, the only terms that involve only epsilon are ones where this G2 has acted like the identity and come out. The only thing involving two G2s at second order is where this G1 inverse has acted like the identity and come out. So we don't get any terms that depend on eta squared or epsilon squared. So gamma C had to be a linear combination of eta and epsilon. And so, using that, we write that explicitly. Gamma C is some linear combination. Let's call the coefficient CABC of eta and epsilon. So the C's are just some constants. And now, this then since this whole G3 equals G2 inverse, G1 inverse, G2, G1, for all G1, for all, well, what we need is eta and epsilon. We conclude that the commutator has to equal these constants times that G. So the commutator of GA with GB is equal to CABC GC. So we infer, right, this gives us the product on the algebra. All right. What this says is that the commutator of eta with epsilon is equal to gamma. Right? That's the commutator on the full vector space. And now all I'm doing is extracting the consequence for the basis vectors. So this is on the vector space. This is the generators. Or equivalently, we could call it the basis. So from a generic commutation relation that holds everywhere in the neighborhood of the identity, we conclude that this has to be true for the infinitesimal generators. We can actually transport this relationship, all of these relationships, to any point on the manifold, because if we're at the identity and we have all these relationships, if we just multiply every element of the neighborhood of the identity by any G, it moves the whole picture up to G on the manifold, and we do the same infinitesimal development up there. So really, all of the points of the manifold look the same because we've got this group product that takes a neighborhood of the identity to a neighborhood of any point on the manifold. So this is what the tangent plane to the manifold looks like. These G's are just basis vectors in the tangent plane. Okay, so we've got a commutator algebra. Are you ready for the Jacobi identities?
What about these again?
Let me draw a picture. Okay, so we've got our manifold equal to the group.
we've got the identity, and what we're looking at is an infinitesimal neighborhood of the identity. We're really looking at the set of directions away from the identity, and then extending finitely by allowing out finite linear combinations of these gives us a plane, an n-dimensional plane. That's the tangent plane at this point. But now, that's the identity. Pick any g here. Multiply g by every element of the neighborhood of the identity, you get an identical. Just by multiplying by g, you take this whole picture right up to that point. Right? Because the group multiplication, now it's continuous. Points near 1 are going to map near to g times 1. So it will preserve that infinitesimal neighborhood and all this structure transport.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Other questions? There are plenty of room for questions here.
How about it? You good?
Could you run through that last little tiny bit? Start just before the arrow.
No,
the other arrow.
There.
Yep.
Down here.
Uh huh.
Okay. Look at this relationship here. This is what I would call gamma. Eta g is what I would call eta. Epsilon g is what I would call epsilon. So, dropping the ones, canceling the ones here, we have gamma equals eta epsilon, the commutator.
Right.
Okay.
You see it?
Yeah.
So, this is something that holds for any eta and epsilon in the neighborhood of the identity. Near.
Right.
There's always some gamma that satisfies this.
Did you think that if you opted in and you're going to some other direction in the manifold, it's just right?
Yeah. You change the parameters by eta or by epsilon. You've moved to another point. By continuity, it's a nearby point.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions here? Okay.
Good.
Goodbye.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay. So, what's the Jacobi identity? Where does it come from? We've used all but one property of the group here. We've used closure to write G3. We've used the existence of inverses to write G1 inverse and G2 inverse, and the existence of an identity to have a place to start the whole thing. We haven't used associativity yet. And associativity, you'll see pretty quickly, is necessary for the Jacobi identity. What you'd like to do is just write the Jacobi identity in terms of the group element, expand, the ones go away, and the linear stuff gives it to you. Why can't I do it? Do you see why I can't? So, I claim we cannot take a commutator of G1 with G2 with G3, plus other stuff equal to something. What's wrong with doing this? We're in trouble, let's see. We're in trouble very quickly here.
We don't know what it maps to different places in the manifold. Like, yeah.
What is...
Yes, you are the identity, that's the problem.
What is G2, G3? What's the problem? Well, pick any G2, any G3.
You're not thinking of the identity necessarily.
How's this defined?
G2 times G3 minus G3 minus G3 times G2.
What does it mean to take the difference of two group elements? What's the difference or the sum of two points on the manifold? It's a manifold. It's not a vector space. You can't add them.
We only have one operation here. It's group multiplication,
right?
We cannot add group elements.
Right.
So there's no such thing as a commutator in the group. You can take these compound products like we did, and you build up a commutator, but we can't do this. No addition of group elements.
So is it going to be more like proving it smooth?
All right. The thing that we'd like to do is, the thing we can do is look at one term of this. We can consider something like G1 times G2 times G3, which is a piece of this. We can put all the pieces together then. So we can look at something like this at whatever order we need to, and then figure out what happens when we start putting them together, because once we get an expression that lies in the algebra, right, that algebra arose because we did a Taylor series. And a Taylor series knows about addition and subtraction. We can add elements of the vector space. So this is a good reason for going to the tangent space. Going to the Lie algebra gives us linearity. It gives us another operation. Not only can we multiply these things, we can add them as well. So we've got a lot more flexibility in what we can do. Okay, so let's see what we can do. The only real concern is that we're going to end up needing something to something like the cubic order. But I think it's going to be associativity coming to the rescue. I hope so. Let's see what happens.
Cubic order is ugly.
Let's try multiplying 1 plus epsilon times 1 plus eta plus times 1 plus gamma. So we've got a G1, a G2, and a G3 in a neighborhood of the identity of that. And that we can write the first order, eta plus gamma. That looks good. We need higher order, but let's see, the thing that really bails us out here is associativity. Okay. Certainly this addition is associative, no problem. But as we go to higher and higher order, what are we going to get? We're going to get, let's go one order higher. We're going to have epsilon eta. We're going to have an epsilon gamma. We're going to have an eta gamma. Those are the second order terms.
No, I'm going to have second order from each one.
What's that?
Well, if we want to go to higher order, we have to put those in higher order too, right?
Yeah.
So you got half epsilon.
So there's other stuff.
Plus half epsilon squared plus half.
Yeah, other stuff like that. But this isn't, even here we're not to associativity. The place where, so we've got other terms here, but where we run into... If we're taking G2 times G3, the cubic term we get here
where these are different, it's going to look like this. And then we have epsilon. We probably need to carry it a cubic order, I think, to really see it. Well, these terms are no problem when it comes to a cubic order associativity of something where you've got epsilon squared in it. Certainly epsilon cubed stuff is no problem. Epsilon squared times eta, you'd really like that to be epsilon times epsilon eta. Right, so what we want to do, if we can establish that the multiplication in the Lie algebra is associative using associativity of the group product, then I think if we just write out the Jacobi identity, it's immediate. So let's try to establish associativity. Does it work? No, it doesn't. How do we know it doesn't work? Associativity of the bracket doesn't work, but of the group elements, I think, does. The Jacobi identity is a kind of a triple product. It's a sort of a generalization of associativity. But that's for the bracket product. Remember, we have this commutator product on the Lie algebra. But we also have just a normal group product. We know what it means to take the product of two generators, because we know what it means to take the product of two group elements. So if we can establish associativity, then consider our three elements. If we have epsilon, eta, gamma, plus eta, gamma, is it going to work? Well, if we just write this out, what is it? Then gamma, epsilon, eta, that's equal to epsilon times eta, gamma, minus gamma, eta, minus eta, gamma, minus gamma, eta, epsilon, and then a bunch more terms. Let's just keep going. Plus gamma, epsilon, eta, minus eta, epsilon, minus epsilon, eta, minus eta, epsilon, gamma. Now, if it's associative, I can just drop all the parentheses, distribute and drop parentheses. We get epsilon eta gamma minus epsilon gamma eta. Do they cancel? Gamma epsilon plus gamma eta epsilon plus eta gamma epsilon minus eta epsilon gamma minus gamma epsilon eta plus epsilon gamma eta plus gamma epsilon eta minus gamma eta epsilon minus epsilon eta gamma plus eta epsilon gamma. So, here we go. That looks good. Epsilon gamma eta, we got one?
Epsilon gamma, at the very end.
Way at the end, okay, so that one. Eta gamma epsilon. Here's one. Gamma eta epsilon. Here's one. Eta epsilon gamma. And gamma epsilon eta equals zero. It works if they're associative. So let's bend our energy on proving that associativity of the group implies associativity of the product of just the plain product of two group generators.
Oh, and we know this because the identity, when you do throw it in there, comes out as zero automatically, too.
Yeah.
So you've proven that if it's associative, then G1, you can throw G1, G2, and G3 in there as long as they're potentially not even.
That's it. So I can add an identity to each of these for free.
Right.
So are we done?
That seems for me pretty well.
Now let's see. Now wait a minute, though. No, but then we can't replace those with group elements because we don't know how to add group elements.
Right. I was just saying you could add in the identity and say that this is equivalent to the identity. That's all of it. So we could throw it back.
So we can say 1 plus epsilon with commutator of 1 plus eta, 1 plus gamma. That certainly equals to zero,
right?
Does that mean we're done? I'm not clear that means we're done.
Well, if we have it, if you just use our definition of what 1 plus epsilon 1 of each of those is equal to, then
what
drawn by definition?
What is 1 plus epsilon equal to?
Oh, the identity plus epsilon, and that's G1.
That is G1, but in fact, this is a cubic order relationship. So 1 plus epsilon is not G1 to cubic order.
Got it.
And we can't do the additions with the group elements. So substituting a group element at this point, we have failed to keep track of second and third order elements.
Right.
And we're claiming to add and subtract group elements in the camp. So I think what we need to do is replace these to cubic order and just establish associativity of the multiplication of the generators. Let's just do it. So let's see. So a general group element to third order, we've got G1. I have epsilon squared, 1/6 epsilon cubed, and we don't need to worry about higher order terms. So when we start to associate these things, and it's going to take three, I think it might be good to look at the let's just look at G1, G2, G3. That has to be equal to G1, G2, G3. That's what we have. So let's just go ahead and write it down. 1 plus epsilon plus half epsilon squared plus 1/6 epsilon cubed. Then this product first, 1 plus eta plus half eta squared, 1/6 eta cubed, times 1 plus gamma plus half gamma squared plus 1/6 gamma cubed. Close bracket. It's not going to be so bad because we drop everything that's over cubic order. So this is G1, G2, G3 is equal to this. And so if we plus epsilon, half epsilon squared, 1/6 epsilon cubed. Then here, 1 plus gamma plus a half gamma squared plus a sixth gamma cubed plus eta gamma, a half eta gamma squared plus half eta squared plus a half eta squared gamma. Now, let's see. Yeah, we're actually we're seeing some things that we don't yet know associated. So those terms we need to keep the order of multiplication
in mind. So what all these powers take precedence over multiplying by some other thing. So anytime we see a symbol like that, we know which was done first. It's always the power that was done first. So I probably don't have to be too careful about that. But there's one more term here, right? We've got this one. Those two go away. Then we have this one times the one. So 1, 6, 8.
This one you have to worry about order of powers because you've got powers.
Right. So when we have more than... When we have all three in the same thing, we really have to worry about it. So we've got all of that, and well, here we go. 1 plus gamma plus, you know, feel free to read a newspaper. really, you know, I'm just writing this out. Eta gamma squared plus a half eta squared plus a half eta squared gamma plus a 6 eta cubed plus now epsilon plus epsilon gamma, no problem, plus a half epsilon gamma squared. This one goes away. Plus epsilon eta plus epsilon times eta gamma. Aha, there's one. Higher order. Not higher order, epsilon eta squared. Higher order. Okay. Epsilon squared, we have a half, epsilon squared, 1/2, epsilon squared gamma. Higher order, up to here, a half, epsilon squared eta. Higher. Then, right, that was the epsilon squared, then epsilon cubed only hits the one.
Hooray.
Whew. Okay, now...
Can I just go over again, changing order?
Yeah, let's see. this is equal to... I'm thinking we might get away without writing it out, because let's take a look at what could change. Certainly, zeroth order thing. Linear order, additions associative. Quadratic order, again, there's no ambiguity in the order of multiplication, so we'll end up with all the same terms. It's only they can only differ at cubic order. So let's write the cubic order terms that don't obviously have an order to them. Like some particular thing cubed is just going to cancel on both sides. Right? We'll multiply it all out. Okay, we have an epsilon cubed term. Well, we're still going to have an epsilon cubed term, but there's no ambiguity about the order. So we must have... What? Nothing up to... Now, let's see. All right, but I'll write these just so we can be sure. A half eta gamma squared. A power of a thing... No, wait a minute. Cubic order. So here's another half eta squared gamma. Eta cubed we can drop for sure. Here's a half epsilon... gamma squared, but you know these terms are going to drop too. So we have epsilon quantity gamma. Wait a minute, what's the order here? Eta gamma. Then half epsilon eta squared. half epsilon squared gamma. And the epsilon cubed obviously goes away. This has to be equal to what can be different. Okay? The thing is, every time we've got something squared, we only took the product of two things. We took the product of an epsilon here with an eta squared there, or an epsilon squared here with a gamma there. That's the only way those quadratic things could arise, because there's no eta here to give another eta squared there. There's no issue of order with any of these. So, the same... Well, I'll write them. All right, so, same stuff. Does anybody doubt this? But here we have epsilon eta first, then gamma. These terms can only arise in a single way, each of those others. So, epsilon eta gamma equals epsilon eta gamma, and the algebra is associative on product of generators. That is A G times G B times G C equals G A G B G C. And as we showed, that implies the Jacobi identity.
And does the Jacobi identity only have to hold on the little ones,
or? On the generators. It holds on the generators.
Just on the first-order generators, or do we have to worry about that mattering?
No, this is what we want. Okay, what we proved here is that this is zero if multiplication of elements of the algebra is associative.
Right.
We just proved it's associative.
But what about if you put higher order, like epsilon and then one half epsilon squared into that? Does that matter?
We just showed that it didn't. Right. We just carried the whole thing to cubic order.
Yeah, here, but like in there, doing the actual brackets, is it going to be different if we throw in those square terms?
No. Everything here is cubic order.
Right.
Right. There's nothing but cubic order here.
Right.
So what we've shown is, we've shown that this is the only property we used in showing that this is zero.
Right. That is zero.
That's all we
need. So we don't need to worry about throwing in the epsilon plus something else.
No. We've done the work here. Right. We did the work in two pieces. That saves us doing that. So we did the addition stuff here, and we did the Jacobi stuff there.
And why couldn't we do that? I'm not quite seeing it just yet.
Okay. From here on, you agree we've proved the
Right. Associativity
of this.
No, I agree with everything. I just don't know.
No, I know, but okay. So forget we've done this for the moment. We've just proved the associativity of arbitrary product of generators. Arbitrary product of the algebra is associative. Now write this. And use only that property. That's all we use to go from this step to that step.
Like a letter here, one, two.
It's better, you know. Yeah. if that's easier to see. You see?
I'm still having trouble, but I'll get
there. Okay, so... there's a thing called a free algebra. If you have, you have some things you know how to multiply, you can consider the linear combinations of all orders of product of that thing. No, that's actually where these things over here live, these cubic things. Of our Lie algebra, you know, we can consider arbitrarily high order products of these things or these things equivalently. You know, just contract epsilon, eta, and gamma onto this, and you've got that. We can claim associativity of that Lie algebra product. It doesn't matter how we clump the group generators. And so if we've got, G1, G7, G3, G2, G8. We don't have to put parentheses in here, like that. We don't need those parentheses. Given that, that's the same as G1, G7, G3. This is the simplification that associativity allows us. It doesn't matter how we make one. From here on, we've proved that property for elements of the Lie algebra. So now I ask you to consider this particular combination of things for any three elements of the Lie algebra.
Okay.
And I know how to add and subtract, so I can write out this line. Here I still kept track of the order of multiplication, but I don't have to. So addition is distributive, this multiplication is distributive, and now it's also associative, so I can drop the parentheses here.
You just went higher order distributive, associative.